Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
The most interactive sports talk show in Houston continues now.
What's happening, Paul? Most interactive show, and I really enjoy that aspect of it. Y'all keep it up.
Get involved in the conversation by dialing or texting 713-780-3776. Here's Paul Gallant.
Patch, great in for Paul Gallant. Paul Gallant Show, ESPN 97.5. We're going to do a little... I'm going to make sure we live up to Paul's interactive requirements here. So on the Twitch channel, they're talking about the McRib sandwich. And are you missing anything if you don't get a McRib? A McRib is Play-Doh in really bad barbecue sauce. That's what it is. It sits in a vat of just nasty, never-changed sauce until it gets sold. The only thing you're missing is agita. So if you haven't had one, do your digestive tract a favor and keep it that way. It'll kill you. I don't even know if BK will eat one. And BK will eat anything. All right, let's hit to the phones. Gary, you're on the Paul Gallant Show. What's up, Gary?
Yeah, McRib, horrible. I agree with that. Super, super horrible. Secondly, Darrell Revis and Troy Aikman. Let me tell you, what would have happened if they would have benched Darrell Revis at some point, or if we would have benched Troy Aikman when he went 1-15? So there is something to what the coach was saying, letting them get their nose bloody. At some point, you got to determine if the guy is good or not.
Well,
but
Gary, I'm going to let you keep talking, but they did bench Troy Aikman. Steve Walsh got their one win. They did bench him.
Yes. Yeah, and so, and then the next year he came back, but he did start the season. I know they benched him or whatever, but they did. What I'm saying, they still rolled him out, basically. And like Darrell Revis, like you're saying, that was a good point. He kept getting burnt toast. Something about that experience does play a big factor in it, but at some point you got to know your personnel as well. So I agree with that, but you just got to, at what point do you say, okay, you don't need any more experience on the battlefield. We're just going to sit and watch film.
Well, again, Gary, I'm not talking about sitting them the rest of the season. Just, maybe you need a week or two to reset your head.
Okay.
Let's focus on the things that you're doing wrong. Get you better prepared when we put you back out there. I'm not talking about sitting them the rest of the year, but at least a game or two.
Okay, that sounds great. Great job. Great, that makes sense. Good. Okay, thank you.
All right, appreciate the call, Gary. On the text line, we got a ton of texts. Somebody said, Katie asks, who's more likely to be on the opening day roster for the Yankees? Trevor Bauer, Cody Bellinger, or Carlos Correa? I so want to say Bauer just to troll, but I don't think Trevor Bauer is ever going to play baseball again. Not in America. And not for the Toronto Blue Jays either. What that guy did is beyond disgusting. I don't care if he was able to convince a court that, quote, she wanted it. She asked me to. Here are the text messages. She said, beat the hell out of me. If you as a man are willing to beat the hell out of a woman, you are the ultimate POS. And as far as I'm concerned, you can die. So if he wants to go play baseball in China, in Japan, wherever, I don't care. I'm playing Major League Baseball ever again. That ship has sailed. I don't think Carlos Correa will ever be a Yankee because the Yankees talk too much trash about Correa. And Correa, of course, gave him the, hey, if you don't know what you're talking about, you need to STFU, which I will always love Carlos Correa. Cody Bellinger, I guess, would be the best option because he's still young. He'll wind up being on like a one-year prove-it deal where he's going to try to get his numbers back up to at least respectability and then go back out on the market and get himself the long-term deal he wants. You know, his agent's out there talking about, well, you know, it's a shoulder injury. His shoulder's not right yet. That's what the problem is. It's not that all of a sudden he can't hit. He is an excellent defensive player. He's a jackwagon, but he's an excellent defensive player. If the Yankees were going to sign one of those guys, Cody Bellinger's the one guy who'd be coming on the cheap and isn't coming with the baggage of, you know, beating women. I'll go with Cody Bellinger on that one. You know, some of the other comments on the text line, somebody liked the Thundercats reference, which is good. I'm glad that people are still old enough to know that there are Thundercats. That was one of my favorite shows as a kid, watching Thundercats. So I said, well, why are we paying attention to the Texans? They're terrible. They're an NFL team in our city. Now, granted, I wasn't here when you didn't have an NFL team in your city, but I've heard John Granato, I've heard Fred Fowler talk ad nauseum about how much not having a football team absolutely sucked. So I would rather cover a bad football team than have no football team to cover, because what would we do if we had no football team to cover? We'd have to talk about the Cowboys. And honestly, I'd rather get the job done with sandpaper than have to talk about the Cowboys really more than once a week. Somebody had asked in, if the Astros don't get Abreu or Bell, what about Brandon Drury? We're going to get to the first base stuff in the next segment. Russ doesn't have that dog in him. I don't think he does either. That soundtrack to Judgment Night is sick. I'm surprised we agree on something. I can already tell you I know who that is. And, yeah, we don't generally agree on most things. But that Judgment Night soundtrack is badass. Now, somebody has entered the Justin Verlander chat. According to Ken Rosenthal, the New York Metropolitans are speaking with Justin Verlander. And look, we know this about the Mets under Stevie Cohen. There's no such thing as financial restraints. The Mets payroll is going to blast $300 million this year. No question. And realistically, if you're the Mets and you're weighing Verlander versus DeGrom, DeGrom right now is a much bigger injury risk than Justin Verlander, despite the age difference. Understand that Jacob DeGrom missed over a year before coming back to the Mets in August. Missed over a year with elbow pain, forearm pain, and a stress reaction in his pitching shoulder blade. Jacob DeGrom did not have surgery for any of these things and is a guy who's worked a ton of innings. He throws ridiculously hard for a guy who's a little more slender. DeGrom, I think, is about 190 pounds. You know, you think about how hard Verlander throws. Verlander's 6'5" and 235 pounds. He's a horse. DeGrom, he's not built like Verlander. I don't honestly don't think DeGrom is even 200 pounds. I think he's about a buck 90. And when you consider the arm action, how much snap on his arm, it doesn't. He's 6'4 and 180 pounds. He's a point guard. He's 180 pounds. He throws 100 miles an hour. He throws a 95 mile an hour slider. You know, and then you look at, you know, his workload. 201, 217, 204. Then they had the COVID season. And then since then, well, he's thrown 92 and 64 innings. And he is going to be 35 years old with a guy who's got elbow pain, forearm pain. And we know what forearm pain means because, well, you know, we have Lance McCullers Jr. We kind of know. We know what forearm pain means because, well, we have Justin Verlander. We know what that means. So, yeah, Jacob DeGrom, to me, much bigger risk than Justin Verlander. Generally speaking, a guy coming off of Tommy John, once he gets through that first season and is healthy, generally that guy is not considered an injury risk anymore because of how successful Tommy John surgery is. When you have one TJ, the success rate is phenomenal. When you have the second TJ, your success rate falls straight into the bucket. Because the first time you have it, the hole they drill in your arm is a clean hole. It's basically like getting a new arm. The second time you have it, there's all the scar tissue and junk and everything in there. Now it's you know, we're patching it up. It's not, doesn't have that same feel, that same strength. Like, it's, oh, it's brand new, I'm indestructible. You don't feel that way after the second one. That's why pitchers after their second Tommy John surgery, their career's pretty much over. But that first one, man, guys come back, they throw harder than ever. So some fun with the guys on the text line. But you know what? Justin Verlander and the Mets, if Verlander really wants to chase 300 wins, then his number one option should be the Astros. Nobody has been more consistent in their success on the field, regular season and postseason, for the last 6 years than the Houston Astros. Six straight ALCS. We might as well just call it the Astros Invitational. Four World Series in 6 years, including two championships. Verlander is comfortable pitching at Minute Maid Park. The Astros play tremendous defense. They're one of the best defensive teams in the league. They are strong behind the plate. They're strong at short. They're strong at center. Verlander isn't going to get a better option in the American League. The only team that's going to be able to give him what the Astros give him is the Dodgers. And we already know what the Dodgers think about Astros players, even though the Dodgers were also cheating. Ask Cody Bellinger. Look at his numbers. If Justin Verlander were to decide, you know what, I'm more concerned about beating Max Scherzer's money than I am about getting my 300 wins in the next 3 years, and he wants to go sign with the Mets, who, as well as they played last year, they have a history of being wildly inconsistent. I mean, the year before, the Mets weren't very good. You want to sign with the Mets? Okay. It makes sense for the Mets. It might make sense for Verlander. Not as much sense as being an Astro. The Astros don't need Justin Verlander. He's a luxury for them. He's a great luxury because, look, during the regular season, the guy's a horse. And you have to get through the regular season to get to the postseason. He intimidates a lot of other teams. The Astros play better defense behind Verlander because future Hall of Famer. I mean, you see it in their play. I'm not going to be all that upset if Verlander goes somewhere else. Would it be great to have him here in Houston? Have him chase 300 wins? Have him chase 4,000 Ks? Maybe get, you know, can he possibly get another Cy Young? You know, could Verlander stay here another 3 years, maybe four, and go into the Hall of Fame at least partially as an Astro? I'm pretty sure that's what Jim Crane is thinking. I'm not going to be all that upset if Justin Verlander decides to leave because, well, you know what? Christian Javier is pretty damn good. Luis Garcia is pretty damn good. Framber Valdez is pretty damn good. Lance McCullers, he's pretty damn good. Arcidi's not bad. And young Hunter Brown is, you know, guy kind of looks a lot like Justin Verlander. So if the plan from Crane was, hey, look, go out, go get your best offer, and I'll match it. Okay. And I don't have a problem if the Astros spend a ton of money on Verlander to keep him. I don't. As long as it doesn't prevent them from doing other things on the roster. You can't drop $11 million on a career journeyman reliever like Rafael Montero and then pay $45 million to a 40-year-old pitcher like Verlander and then say, okay, we're too close to the tax line, so we're not going to sign a first baseman and we're not going to sign a left fielder. We're just going to, you know, try to fill it. That can't happen. And I don't think it will happen. I mean, isn't that the whole reason why you gave a reliever $11 million and why you punted on your general manager who went to three straight ALCS, two World Series, and won a world title? Why you punted on that guy because you didn't think he was aggressive enough. Because you wanted him to sign some big players like Starling Marte, and he didn't do it because he felt the price tag was too high. So Jim Crane apparently is not as afraid of that tax line as we may have been led to believe. James Click may have been afraid of that tax line. I'm not worried about Verlander if he decides to go. Honestly, I don't think he will. I think he'll go get whatever the best offer he is, come to Jim Crane, and Jim Crane will say, okay, fine, here's an extra mil. Let's go. Now, their first base target, of course, as we heard, was Anthony Rizzo, and Anthony Rizzo decided to stay with the South Bronx Slumlords. So who's next on their hit list? We'll tell you next.
ESPN 97.5. This is the Paul Gallant Show on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Paul Gallant.
That's great in for Paul Gallant. Paul Gallant Show, ESPN 97.5. Time for free stuff. Free stuff. University of Houston. They take on Tulsa this weekend, celebrating senior night. We'll go caller number four, 713-780-3776, 713-780-ESPN. Caller four gets a pair of tickets. See, University of Houston, Saturday, November 26th, 6:30 p.m., take on Tulsa. Now, you can also purchase a family four-pack. That's four tickets, four dogs, four chips, four sodas, just $96. Go to uhcougars.com/promo, enter promo code TULSA4PACK, or you can call 713-GO-COUGS and get your tickets today. Now, somebody asked me about where the Astros are in relation to the tax line. How much money do they have? So right now, if you include their arbitration estimates, their pre-arb estimates, and you include Montero's deal, on the tax line, because that tax line includes benefits that get paid out, minor salaries, etc., they're at $178 million. Now, the tax line is $233 million. So they are right now $55 million under the first tax line. They're $75 million under the second tax line. You can go up to $253 million before you incur the next set of penalties. And considering the Astros had to give up draft picks as part of the sign-stealing nonsense, and they got fined, I don't think Jim Crane right now is willing to go over 253 because then the penalties start to get a little bit too hard. You know, they still have a lot of stuff that they need to do with this team as far as getting their picks in order and getting their minor league system in order. You don't want to be giving things away. But 253 is still a really strong payroll. And for all the players on this team who are arbitration or pre-arb, you can put together a hell of a team at 253. I mean, think about, so arbitration guys for the Astros this year. Fromber, it's his second year. Fromber is probably going to be a Super 2, so this will be his last year of arbitration. He will probably be a free agent next year. Kyle Tucker is going into his first year of arbitration. Stanek's in his final year of arb. Jose Urquidy, year one. Christian Javier, year one. Maton's in his final year of arb. Dubon's going to his first year of arb. Brian Abreu doesn't hit arbitration until next year. Then you have guys like Ronel Blanco, Hunter Brown, Yainer Diaz. All these guys are pre-arb. Luis García doesn't hit arb until next year. Hensley's pre-arb. Corey Lee's pre-arb. Seth Martinez. Chaz doesn't hit arb until next year. Jake Myers is 2 years out. Pena doesn't hit arb for 3 years. His arbitration starts 2025. So they got a lot of guys who are making minimums or they're under team control with arbitration. So if you give Verlander $45 million a year because he wants to beat Max Scherzer, you're $10 million under the tax line. You want to get a left fielder, you want to get a first baseman, that might cost you $30 million or so. That'd keep you under the first tax line, like under that first penalty line. If you're at 253, you're in the first set of penalties, which aren't really that bad. Now, we heard about Anthony Rizzo being the Astros' first choice at first base, mainly because terrific glove, hits for power, draws walks, gets hit by pitch, almost a three true outcome player. But as far as who's up next, there's really only two targets. And John Heyman had said that the Astros were now interested in Josh Bell. Last year, Josh Bell signed a one-year, $10 million deal, so he really shouldn't be looking at some kind of gigantic deal. Maybe 2 years, $30 million, $15 million a year. And then Ken Rosenthal had mentioned the Astros being interested in Jose Abreu. Now, Rosenthal mentioned, actually, John Morosi had actually mentioned it first, but that the Astros having continued interest in Abreu, who the Padres are also in on Abreu. There's going to be competition for everybody because there's not a lot of guys at first base. At this point, it's literally Abreu or Bell. And to be honest, if it's not going to be one of those two guys, I don't know that I would go out and try to fill that position outside the organization. I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of guys who are going to be worth it for you at that point. Now, someone had mentioned Brandon Drury. Brandon Drury had a career-high 28 homers this year. 20 of them came in Cincinnati, which is a bandbox. When he got to San Diego, still hit some homers, but the average fell off. The on-base fell off. Slugging fell off. His OPS fell. Everything fell off. He's also not a very good fielder. And I'm going to look into it here real quick, but I want to say that he's got splits. And yeah, he does. He hits well against lefties and not so well against righties. 299 against lefties last year, 248 against righties. 955 OPS against lefties, 757 against righties. Those are big splits. He profiles as a platoon guy on a team that's going to be as good as the Astros. Now, this is something I've been thinking about the last few days. Because I like Josh Bell. I know Josh Bell's not a great fielder, but you get Josh Bell on a short-term deal. You don't have to worry about him, aging out into a DH. You have him on a short-term deal. But he's a guy who's a switch hitter, a power hitter, and has no splits. He hits equally well, average and power, both sides of the plate. And when you consider the fact that there will be no shift in Major League Baseball starting next year, you can no longer have the second baseman play halfway out in right field. You can no longer have the shortstop playing second base. You now have to have all four infielders on the infield. You cannot be further than the edge of the outfield dirt. Two guys have to be on each side of second base. So the best thing you can do is play your shortstop basically a foot off second base and then have him go run over to second base as the pitcher's being delivered. That's about the best you can do. But a lot of those ground balls that go to, shallow to medium depth right field that turn into outs, those balls are hit at 110 miles an hour. Those balls are smoked. If you're playing second base and the deepest you can be is on the cutout, you're not going to have time to get that ball unless it's basically hit within one step of you. Those balls are rockets. So one of the things, if you're not going to have a guy, whether it's Bell or Abreu, if you're not going to bring in that kind of bat, I don't want to pay money for a guy who's not going to give me that kind of production and is also not going to be, the kind of fielder that you want. And, do you go with Yuli for another year if you don't get either one of those guys, knowing, hey, Yuli saves my infielders a ton of errors every year. Yuli is an excellent defender. Does he bounce back a little bit with the bat? Do you feel like, all right, well, in his postseason, he was terrific. Can he bounce back a little bit with the bat? Now, maybe he can or maybe he can't, but, how do you feel about it? Because obviously he'd be cheap. Where do you sit with him in that regard? And then I thought about this from a different point of view. David Hensley is going to be on this team. Now, ideally, he is going to be on this team as a utility guy. But if you can't get Bell and you can't get Abreu, it doesn't make sense to overpay for a middling guy. It's okay to overpay guys in baseball if they're Justin Verlander. It's okay to pay Aaron Judge. You could pay elite talent. It's okay to overpay those guys. You don't want to overpay mediocre talent. David Hensley, 6'6". He's a real big target. And he can play first base. If you're concerned, all right, well, Yuli's not going to give me a good enough bat for a whole season. You play David Hensley at first base, gives you a good solid bat, takes pitches, draws walks, has power, and he can play. I mean, look, he can play anywhere on the infield. He plays first, he plays second, he plays third, he plays left field. He's played short. I mean, I wouldn't want to have him playing short regular. But if you needed him in a pinch, you could do it. If it's not going to be Josh Bell and it's not going to be Jose Abreu, I think I might be more inclined to stick with Yuli or give Hensley a shot at first base as opposed to overpay for somebody who's not going to give me anything proven. If I'm going with mostly unproven, I'll go with my own guys. Let me get the best outfielder I can get, and I'll live with, you know, Hensley or Yuli at first and bat him eighth. Now, the rules are changing in Major League Baseball, and there's probably going to be a few different ways that they impact the Houston Astros. And we'll get to some of those things next.
ESPN 97.5. You're locked in with the Paul Gallant Show.
You're locked in here with me.
Please send help from the Veritex Community Bank Studios. Here's Paul Gallant.
Patch Creighton in for Paul Gallant. Paul Gallant Show. Me tomorrow. Paul is partying hard in the newest of Englands and enjoying himself and probably listening to people in Boston Sports Radio lose their minds and talk about chatter. Baseball's going to have a whole bunch of new rules this year. And all we've heard from baseball for the last several years is, got to make the game shorter, got to make the game shorter, got to make the game shorter. Well, they're putting some new rules in. Some are going to do that and some aren't. Now, I've gotten to see a lot of these new rules play because of the amount of time that I've spent with the Sugarland Skeeters / Space Cowboys, working with them, calling games the last several years. And I will tell you, the pitch clock works and almost never actually comes into play. For all the games that I did in the Independent League, in the Independent Atlantic League at AAA, not once did a pitcher ever have a ball called on them because they exceeded the time limit on the pitch clock. Not once. But they get on there and they're ready to go. They all, like all those pitchers, they know, get on the mound, let's go. You don't have, if you guys remember Steve Traxel, the human rain delay, you know, used to get on, get off, get on, get off, get on, get off. Mike Pelfrey, the hand licker, he'd walk around the mound, lick his hand two times, get on the mound, lick his hand again. Yeah, some guys just took forever. I used to hate going to Met games when Al Leiter pitched because Al Leiter, every game was 4 hours. That dude worked so slow, and he gave up a million foul balls. You knew if Leiter was pitching, if Traxel was pitching, you're going to be there all night. But the pace of the game will move. And, you know, baseball with testing the pitch clock in the minor league said, hey, the game was 26 minutes shorter with the pitch clock. That's a big difference. If you could take every game in Major League Baseball and shorten it by 26 minutes just by having the guy get on the mound and no longer letting the batter step out every time. Because you saw that in the World Series, how the Phillies batters, they just kept stepping out, every pitch, stepping out. You can't do that anymore. Get in the box, let's go. There's no more of that, you know, when I was a kid, it was Lenny Dykstra. After every pitch, step out, undo the gloves, redo the gloves, reset the grip. Sean might be too young for this. No more Garcia Parra. He was famous. Every time, undo the glove, redo the glove. Every time, had to go through the whole routine. Can't do that anymore. Get in the box and let's go. And it's going to be important if baseball can cut the game down by 26 minutes because some of the other rules are probably going to extend it. By no longer having the shift, lefties are going to hit 40 points higher. Maybe more. Top lefties are going to hit a ton higher. Two of the top eight guys shifted against in Major League Baseball, Yordan Alvarez and Kyle Tucker. And how many times, especially the beginning of the year, the last 2 years, have we talked about Kyle Tucker, you know, hitting the ball like a freaking rocket, but right at a defender who just happens to be perfectly placed for him. They're not going to be able to play in those spots anymore. Kyle took his average, Mike, with 50 points. Could you imagine if Yordan and Tucker all of a sudden see 50-point increases in their average, or at least just they're on base? Yordan's on base is already 400. And Tucker's about 330, 335. Can you imagine Yordan's on base 45% of the time? That's like almost Bonds level. And if Kyle Tucker's on base 370 clip, the Astros are going to score a lot of runs. And then not only can you no longer shift, but the pitcher can only throw over to first base twice. If he throws over a third time and he doesn't get the out, it's a balk. And all runners advance. Which basically means they're never throwing over a third time. Nobody has that Andy Pettit move anymore. Nobody's throwing the ball over a third time and risking a balk. Not unless they're convinced, hey, you know what, I'm going to intentionally walk this batter anyway, set up first and second, give me a force at any base on the infield, set up an infield fly. You know, we're going to give ourselves every opportunity to get a force out or an out an easy way. There's going to be a lot more stolen bases next season. And even though Jose Altuve doesn't steal bases like he used to, do you guys realize he stole 18 bags in 19 attempts this year? That's a phenomenal success rate. Now that teams can't check on him as much, he'll probably get a better read, a better jump. You think Altuve might find 30, 40 stolen bases next year? How about Jeremy Pena? Jeremy Pena flies. Chas McCormick. Kyle Tucker had, what, 25 stolen bases? 26 stolen bases? Tucker might steal 40. These guys are going to have so many opportunities to run. Between the pitcher not being able to throw over, the bags being a little bit bigger, you're going to get better reads. That's going to extend games. People like the action. They're going to want to see the stolen bases. It's going to extend the game. There's going to be a lot more hits. There's going to be more guys on. That means more pitches. Pitchers do work slower when this guy's on base. So the overall length of the game probably won't change. But the amount of action in the game very much could change because anybody with any speed is going to be looking to go. And the Astros got plenty of guys who can hit for power. It'd be very interesting to see how many more stolen bases wind up coming on. Because you do have guys who can run. Altuve, Pena, Tuck, Chaz. I don't know where Jake Myers fits in this team. He's another guy who runs like a deer. If Dubon is still here, Dubon runs. They have guys who can run. Now, I don't know who they're going to sign to play left field with Yordan. If it's Michael Conforto, he's not going to run. If it's Brandon Nimmo, Brandon Nimmo's going to run. And I would love to see Nimmo on the Astros. Another left-hand bat. He's already a career 385 on-base guy. He's your leadoff guy. You get Altuve out of the leadoff spot. Altuve doesn't want to be in the leadoff spot. He hits leadoff because the team needs him to hit leadoff. He doesn't want to hit leadoff. How about Altuve hitting second with a guy on base nearly 40% of the time that Altuve comes up? Runs, cha-ching. Nimmo, Altuve, Yordan, Bregman, Tucker. Yeah, that top five is going to rake. I'm all for that. And because you can't shift, being able to go lefty, righty is going to matter more. Because teams can no longer bring in right-handed pitchers out of the bullpen and just pound lefties inside to force them to pull the ball into the shift. A lot of right-handed pitchers are going to have to learn how to get lefties out other than pound the guy inside and let him hit it into the shift. Because there's no more shift. They're going to have to learn how to set guys up and get them to try to pull pitches off the outside part of the plate to turn them over. Not every pitcher can do that. It's going to be a lot harder for bullpens to match up with teams that can go righty-lefty, righty-lefty, because those splits are going to start to manifest again. Reliever splits are going to become even bigger. That's one of the unintended consequences of this, is how reliever splits are going to change. No longer are teams going to be like, oh, we'll just, you know, get a righty in there, throws big breaking stuff inside, and he'll make the guy pound it down and hard into the shift. That's over. You know, the left-handed bat, and Nimmo's the guy who can play left field, can play center field, can play right field. Brandon Nimmo fits this team absolutely perfectly. High average, high on base, has some pop, has speed, terrific defender. That's exactly the kind of guy that that I want them to sign. And the projection for him was 5 years and $100 million. Every projection where they do, how much does it cost millions of dollars per war? Brandon Nimmo comes out as a bargain. Every single one. That's the guy. All right, coming up next, we'll get into the World Cup. And, of course, we'll honor Mr. Gallant with some garbage time. It's coming up next.
ESPN 97.5. Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's the Paul Gallant Show on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Open wide for some soccer!
The Continental Soccer Association is coming to Springfield. It's all here. Fast kicking, low scoring, and ties. You bet.
You know, ties and disappointment. Is that not what the U.S. men's national team is? Disappointment. Every year since 2002. Do you realize since 2002... The men's national team has gotten out of group stage twice. And both times they lost their very first game in the round of 16. Both times 2-1 and both times in overtime. In 06, they didn't even make it out of group stage. And of course in 2018, they didn't even qualify. So having the chance to get 3 points against Wales, and they spit the bit. It almost seemed good, you know. They did get a goal early on.
Pulisic on the run. Pulisic has Weah. Pulisic rolls it in. Tim Weah!
That guy gets stabbed. He might be having a convulsion or something. I don't know what that was. But they were up 1-0. And then they get to, what was the 80th second minute or so, and one of their defenders decides he's going to basically deck a guy right in front of the goal, and it winds up being a penalty kick. You know, penalty kicks from like, what is it, 10 feet away? It's almost impossible to not convert a penalty kick. Usually when guys miss penalty kicks, it's a big deal about how that guy choked. Well, they didn't choke.
Bale scores.
That's it. Bale scores. And they tied 1-1 in a game they should have won. I was trying to figure out, what is it that would cause the men's national team to not play as well, to not finish the job? And I could only come up with one thing. It was this phone call.
Showtime, guys. You ready? It says POTUS. That's where it's coming from. three of the U.S. men's national soccer team.
Coach, put me in. I'm ready to play. You guys, I know you're the underdog, but I'll tell you what, man, you got some of the best players in the world on your team, and you're representing this country, and I know you're going to play your hearts out. So let's go shock them all. Keep trusting in one another. Play as hard as you can. And, you know, for you and your families, your teammates, and the whole country's rooting for you.
That's a very nice message, Mr. President. The whole team is here right now, and we really appreciate your support, and we're ready to go. Guys, you want to say hi? You get any of that?
I got some of it. I got some of it.
A lot of thank yous and a lot of hellos.
I wish I were there to see you. I really do. Go get them, guys. Just play your hearts out.
We got this.
I know you will. I know you will.
All right. That was nice.
You know, the only thing worse than the lack of excitement that you heard by the national team getting that phone call was if you watch the video and look at their faces and they are just like, why are we doing this?
It's the most like a classroom, like, hi, Mr. So-and-so, like, hi, Mr. President.
It's like, do you guys want to say hi to the president?
You can't say no.
I mean, they sound like zombies. Didn't sound very exciting. And I know the president meant well, but I don't think he inspired or energized or really did anything other than make those guys go, oh, my God. Oh, I got to wake up. It's a soccer game. That's got to be the reason, man. That's got to be the reason. Only one I can come up with. All right. You know what? Time for garbage time.
Oh, I love trash.
Garbage time.
It's garbage.
Starts now.
I'm now, the trash man.
This is garbage.
You guys might remember a guy named Garrett Cole used to pitch here. And then after Game 7 of the World Series, he put on a Scott Boras hat, and he acted like garbage. Well, Blue Jays All-Star Alek Manoah, he was on Sportsnet's How Hungry Are You with Serge Ibaka, and he got asked a very interesting question that wound up involving Garrett Cole.
So you ready?
Yeah.
All right, let's do it. Who is the worst cheater in baseball history?
In baseball history?
Yeah.
Cheater?
Yeah.
Garrett Cole.
Garrett Cole, what he did?
Yeah, he cheated. He used a lot of, like, sticky stuff.
Yeah.
To make his pitches better.
Wow.
And he kind of got called out on it.
Okay.
Yeah. Garrett Cole, you cheater! Wait, doesn't he play for the Yankees? Isn't the Yankees general manager Brian Cashman the guy who blamed not winning a World Series since 2009 on cheating so horrific by the guy you signed? Would that be the cheater? I love Al Manoah. If you guys watched the All-Star game, he was mic'd up and he was talking all sorts of trash. It was awesome. Manoah's the guy, you love his personality. If he was an Astro, we'd love that dude. I still like him, even though he's on the Blue Jays, because Blue Jays aren't beating the Astros. I ain't gonna worry about that. But I did think it was pretty cool. Who's the biggest cheater? Not Barry Bonds. Not Roger Clemens. Not even Alex Rodriguez. Or Manny Ramirez. Not even Don Sutton. Or Gaylord Perry. No. It was Garrett cheating ass Cole. Now, for those of you who don't know, the University of Houston men's basketball team just got a very large NIL deal from our very own Mattress Mac.
Well, two of my children went to U of H. I've always been a big U of H fan. The U of H basketball team is doing very well. I'm a huge Kelvin Sampson fan and felt like it was time to do this NIL deal for seven figures with the Cougars and say, go Cougs for the city.
Seven-figure deal for the Cougars men's basketball team from Mattress Mac. Is there anything that guy doesn't do for the city? By the way, for those of you who don't know, UH men's basketball, 5-0, ranked number 2 in the nation. Number 2 on the AP, on the coaches poll. Number 2. And they're playing Tulsa this weekend at home. And you can go get those 4-packs. 713 Go Cougs. So Mattress Mac, again, putting the money where the mouth is, supporting the city of Houston, school of Houston, everything Houston. Mac's a legend. One day when I grow up, I want to be just like Mattress Mac. Just, I want to curse more. Because, you know, I tend to do that. Appreciate all our callers, texters, tweeters, and twitchers. My man Sean Mapes on the other side of the glass. Coming up next, Joel Blank, Jeremy Branham, Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5.
This is Heisman Trophy winner Troy Smith, and you're listening to ESPN 97.5. Go Bucks.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I got to say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.